Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every weekday from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing pretty well. Doing pretty well.
I am doing well, I guess.
Yeah.
Considering.
Yeah. What are you considering?
Well, I'm considering that last night I went to a benefit for the Museum of the American Cocktail.
That would explain the black circles under your eyes.
Yeah. Museum of the American Cocktail, MOTAC for short.
MOTAC.
Brilliant cocktails at a place called the Devon Tavern downtown in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about Museum of the American Cocktail just for a minute. That place is pretty much run by the cocktailians of New York, the people who know about cocktails.
It's the cocktailians of America. I mean,
right.
We should explain to people that the Museum of the American Cocktail was originally built in New Orleans. It survived Katrina, but it lost its home in Katrina. And then it was put up in Vegas for a while. Now things are in storage, but the Museum of the American Cocktail is an organization that and you can find it. I think it's motac.org, motac.org. You can also link to it through our website at restaurantguysradio.com. But it seeks to preserve the history of the cocktail in America, and that's an important part. Many people don't realize that cocktails were actually invented here. But the kind of cocktails we're talking about are historical cocktails, and there are a number of people who, like chefs, great mixologists, they call themselves. Cocktail program is an important part of many fine dining restaurants, including ours.
And so what you have developed here is you have certain bartenders and certain people who are using old cocktails and bringing back classic cocktails and updating them and upgrading them and doing things with them. And then you have another group, and sometimes there's a crossover of these two groups, of course, that are producing brand new cocktails using those premium ingredients, using the traditions of the original cocktails.
Well, the dinner last night was at a place called Devon Tavern, which I'm ashamed to say I had never been to before. The Devon Tavern is downtown on Greenwich Street near Franklin in Manhattan. I apologize to those of you who aren't in Manhattan or planning to be in Manhattan in the area, but it's a lovely, lovely place, opened by the same guy that opened Dylan Prime.
Mm-hmm.
It's been open about a year, and it's just beautiful. The cocktails we had, well, Dale DeGroff was there. He's the preeminent, he's been on the show. He's the preeminent bartender in the world. His son, Leo DeGroff, was one of the guest bartenders. Tony Abuganim from Las Vegas was there. Sasha Petrasky from who has cocktail lounges in both places was there. And it was just a very stylish collection of I would say, mostly industry folk. But the cocktails were brilliant. And you're seeing this more and more. People made these cocktails were one of the problems with a cocktail dinner as opposed to a wine dinner is you don't want to get drunk. At professional events especially, I mean, let's be clear, we kid about it sometimes, but you don't get drunk at a professional wine event or you don't get invited back. Same with cocktails. It's about furthering the industry. It's about making tasty libations that are a part of a meal or a part of an evening. And so they have these tiny little cocktail glasses that we had some On the Rocks cocktails from and some Up cocktails from using some new ingredients. Very seasonal ingredient stuff that's out there now, and mostly new cocktails. No one did classics this time around. They did, I'll throw a couple of recipes up on the website. We're actually going to, I asked permission, Tony Abuganim's recipe uses an ingredient called Aperol, which is kind of like Campari. It's an ingredient from Italy. It's only been available in the country this year. We got our cocktail, the Parasol cocktail, into the Food and Wine Cocktail Book 2007. With
really terrific ingredient. It adds a bitter component and a sweet component and kind of a grapefruitiness. Really interesting beverage for those people who are designing really nice cocktail programs. Aperol should be on it.
I'm amazed, actually. Aperol made an appearance in two different drinks last night. And I'm amazed. We combined it with a Peruvian grape brandy called Pisco.
Mm-hmm.
And Pisco and Aperol, two things that you wouldn't think would go together. And it really made a 1+1=3 magical drink in our case. Tony Abuganim last night married it, did a similar drink to ours, but he mixed Aperol with a really good silver tequila.
Mm-hmm.
And I was surprised at how beautiful the cocktail is. Now, the challenge was they served cocktails through dinner. We had aperitif cocktails in little mm-hmm. glasses. And then through dinner, they brought around a different cocktail with each course of dinner. Food at the Devon Tavern was spectacular. The cocktails were great. I'm still not convinced. We've done a couple of cocktail dinners, and I want to do one again in the future. I still think wine or beer are better with dinner.
It's very hard. I mean, Francis and I have had this discussion between ourselves often, very, very few times on the radio. It's very, very hard to match cocktails all throughout dinner, especially when you start getting to rare red meat and things like that. It's very, very difficult to match cocktails in that way.
There were a few selections that were really spot on. But, you know, the others, and you know, everything was good, and everything was a good match. But to me, you know, it reminds me a little of, although it's much more appropriate than this, when cigars became really fashionable.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I had the great good fortune to go to Spain as a young man, so I learned how to smoke cigars. You know, when cigars became really popular, I was sort of sad because I used to be able to buy a great cigar for $2, and then it was, you know, 20. But when cigars became really popular, there was pressure on us. People kept saying, and we have done cocktail dinners, and they were great. We had Dale DeGroff himself come down. We did two of them. They were amazing. But we had some pressure on us to do cigar dinners.
See, now I think cocktails, in comparison to cigars, are much easier to match with food. Because at least I can pick certain... See, if I'm making the dinner, I can pick certain foods that will match brilliantly to cocktails, and I can kind of form a dinner around the cocktail.
Well, you know what? And that's the key to making a great cocktail dinner, is you form the dinner around the cocktail. You try to make the friendliest cocktails you can, the food-friendliest cocktails you can, and then you have the dinner form around them. But you remember, when you do a wine dinner or a beer dinner or a food dinner, you're matching that cocktail with that food, but you're also, meals go in a progression. You know, mm-hmm. what food comes after what food and what cocktail comes after what cocktail. So it's a little complicated. But the cigar dinner, I remember thinking, and we probably could have made a lot of money doing cigar dinners because people offered us a lot of money to do them because we have a separately ventilated room. Of course, it's useless now because smoking is illegal. But the cigar dinner, I thought, I love cigars. Mm-hmm. I've been smoking cigars since I was 22 years old, and I don't want a cigar with each course of dinner. That's mm-hmm. for after dinner.
Right. Not just that. If you're talking about cocktails or you're talking about beer or you're talking about wine and even certain foods, when you're talking about doing that, there are certain things that we can do as restaurant owners or you can do as consumers that will reset your palate, that will help you kind of rejuvenate.
There's no resetting from a cigar.
There's no resetting from a cigar. Cigar is a one-way train,
right.
Okay? And
the way to reset for a cigar is to wait until tomorrow.
That's bigger cigar. That's how you reset from a cigar, you know?
I have to say, there's one fashion statement that I saw there that I thought was really cool, and I think that...
People wearing cigars as necklaces?
No. Last night at the cocktail dinner, there's this guy named Sasha Petrasky. He's a friend of ours. He owns Milk and Honey in Manhattan and in London, and a couple... And a couple of other cocktail places, and he was wearing last night a tie. Like, he had suspenders on and pants that were a little higher up and a tie that wasn't all the way down to the belt buckle like in the 1940s. Now, Sasha pulled it off. I'm just wondering if that's going to catch on or only Sasha can
pull it off. Okay, let me help you with something. That particular outfit, the tie points at my big fat belly. Look, this man has a big fat belly.
Yeah, he's in better shape than you are. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and today we're talking with Tim O'Shea. Tim's the founder of Clean Fish, a company building the U.S. market for artisan fisheries for wild and cultivated seafood. Now, the face of large-scale industrial fish practices you've heard us talk about a lot, they can sometimes damage marine environments, threaten vital fish stocks, and, well, trying to figure out how to buy fish intelligently is a really complicated matter that we spend a lot of time talking about. Tim can help us with that.
Tim, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you're not just an advocate. You're out there actually bringing clean, environmentally responsible fish to the market so people can actually, you know, eat it.
Absolutely. I was an interested foodie for quite some time and did a lot of work in the environmental movement over a number of years, decades, in fact. I'm gray enough to be able to say that. Basically, the kind of a turning point for me was in January of 2004 out here in San Francisco Bay Area, the press hit with some really deeply disturbing news from Nature magazine about the state of farmed salmon, for one, but fish farming in general and where it was going. And that was followed by weeks and weeks of press that was either first or second page news out here in San Francisco about degraded habitats and overfishing. And I basically looked at this and with real concern and realized that one of the things that was happening was my environmental friends and the press were both inviting us for a fairly knee-jerk, quick-fix response of farm bad, wild good, farm bad, wild good as a mantra.
So let me just, for our listeners who may not be familiar with the issue, what people were saying was that the farmed fish, depending on how they're farmed, can really take a tremendous environmental toll. And while, you know, there is people...
They put a lot of strain on the environment and ecosystems around them.
And so it went from an idea where we thought, well, let's use farm fish because it takes off stresses from the wild fish population, to thinking, well, all farmed fish is bad and all fresh fish is good. And so we vacillated between thinking all farm fish is bad and then all fresh fish is bad. And so wild fish is bad. So then rather than have a knee-jerk reaction, Tim, what's your reaction?
Well, I started to look at what was really causing these problems in both sectors, farmed and wild. And to my eyes, it was the result of industrial-scale practices in both categories. And here, unrecognized and unable to really reach the marketplace with an appropriately strong voice were artisan producers in both categories who really just couldn't get beyond the commodity fray, couldn't get a price that could get them recognized for being not a commodity player. And so I set about looking at other models of, you know, have we seen this before in the marketplace? Well, yeah, there's, you know, Tyson's Chickens and there's Rosie's Organics out here in California. There's Hormel or Smithfield Pork, and then there's Nyman Ranch Family Farms.
Well, so let's give the listeners who may not be familiar with fishing practices an idea of what would be, say, for catching wild fish, what would be some industrial practices that large fishing concerns would engage in, as opposed to maybe a hook-and-line fisherman that would be a fisherman that would sell to your organization that you would then sell to restaurants and consumers?
You bet. Let me go out to your part of the world where I grew up. I'm an East Coast city boy and being raised, actually was raised in Philadelphia and lived in New York. So you guys are
right in the middle.
Turf. And we started working with a hook line fishery out of Chatham, Mass, co-op that are the only guys really allowed to still fish in Georgia's Banks, because since the 70s, trawlers and international fishing groups have come in and just raped and pillaged Georgia's Banks till the cod and a lot of the major fisheries that were a fundamental part of the history of both the economics and the food systems and, frankly, the cultural systems of the entire North Atlantic.
And when you say raped and pillaged, you pretty much mean burned to the ground.
Correct. I mean, you know, when you're putting out football field nets of trawling and you're tracking all these fish with GPS systems, you know, kind of the romance and the sensibility of the skills of fishing kind of go by the boards. What's really terrible about these practices is that along with them and the industrial scale thinking that, you know, is behind them, is just a huge, a grotesque level of waste.
Well, I also want to say it's also bad business. Okay, let's talk about
this is the thing. It's really stone stupid business. That's exactly right.
You know, you fished a whole bunch of cod this year, but now there's no cod to reproduce cod for next year,
well,
and you need to find a new job.
Well, but hold on a second. Let's look at it. It's not the individual fishermen who are making the decision to do this. It's that the huge agribusiness concern or the huge fishing concern can go in and on this, using these methods, get so much fish out of the ocean so cheaply that they can make their profit and be gone in the 5 years that it takes for them to collapse the fishery. Now, of course, when they're done, their corporation dissolves, the people have taken an appropriate level of profit out, but like you said, the fishermen are left with the jobs. But the interest of the corporation is not in business to keep farmers in work. The corporation is not in business to keep a lifestyle afloat. The corporation doesn't give a darn about what happens to the ocean. The corporation
You weren't going to say darn, were you? You were going to say something else.
The corporation seeks to
I had my ears closed.
I think Tommy had his finger up.
What we need to challenge and come back on, because you were exactly right to say this is not good business. The point is that that perception of how to do business is from a failed understanding of what wealth creation is.
You know what? We're going to leave that right there because that's a good point. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with Tim O'Shea, founder of Clean Fish, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standard set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. In Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, and we're speaking with Tim O'Shea, co-founder of Clean Fish, a company that is bringing you and us environmentally responsible and tasty seafood.
Where moments ago, Francis got so upset that he had our engineer very nervous with his finger on the 6-second pause button.
I was going to use one of those words that you're not allowed to use on broadcast radio. So, what you were explaining to us, and we only have a couple of minutes, but how does it happen that? Look, we knew that the Atlantic cod fishery was going to collapse. We were warned that the Atlantic cod fishery was going to collapse. Lo and behold, they keep on with the unsustainable fishing practices, and now there is no more commercial Atlantic cod fishery except for very small concerns because it collapsed, just like the environmentalists said it would. Yeah. How do we get a corporation that says, you know what, I don't care don't corporations see that to fish out all the cod in the New England cod fishery is bad business? Why don't they see that?
Well, this is a very critically important point, is to understand the politics of food. And the issues here are allowed to happen because you're only counting financial capital as what's important, and you're missing the other two ingredients of what creates wealth, which is human capital and natural capital. Only when you include all three are you really in the game of globally appropriate economic practices. And one of the things that we think is really important and why we really are pressing for Clean Fish as a marketing branding aggregator of really great artisan seafood is to emphasize superb seafood that's safe and that's sustainable, and to say to the consumers and people who walk into your restaurants, you have to understand you're voting with your fork at every meal. You can vote for politicians every couple of years, but you vote with your fork every meal that either supports these destructive practices or these sustainable and regenerative practices.
And I think what people need to realize is that absent that, it is economically viable for a corporation to say, you know what, let's go in there, we'll fish out all the fish, we'll have every fish in that part of the ocean out, and who cares if it collapses in 5 years, and they can still make a profit. It is financially, fiscally profitable to do that. And so we need to... the free market does not work by itself in this arena. We need government regulation, and we also need consumers to influence the free market and say, I don't accept that, and
even more than the government regulation, I think that we need people to act on it themselves.
Listen,
the market can act faster to regulate itself than the government can.
Actually, Tim, we're gonna pick up that thought on the other side of the news. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
We're talking today with Tim O'Shea. He's the co-founder of a company called Clean Fish. Clean Fish, I want to point out, is not just an environmental organization. This is a for-profit fish distributor, and they seek out environmentally responsible fish and fish that are good for you and good for the environment and make them available to sale to restaurants and retailers around the country. Now, Tim, we talk with a lot of artisanal producers of vegetables, of animals, of all sorts of food products. And one of the things that we find with farmed products, land farmed products, is we always say that, you know, if you are looking for the most, you know, locally grown, environmentally responsible vegetables, that journey is going to take you to the tastiest and most wonderful vegetables. They're always going to taste better than the commodity vegetables. And if you look, if your sole mission is to go out and find the tastiest tomatoes and you're in Jersey, you're going to find them from a local farm in August. Is it the same with seafood? Does environmentally responsible seafood taste better?
Only completely.
Well, why? And how does that work?
Well, very simply, when you're dealing at a scale where you can pay attention to the stewardship and husbandry issues of growing and raising the fish, when you can take full responsibility for the custody of the fish from brood stock all the way through, I'm now speaking of the aquaculture and mariculture crews, not the wild, when you can choose to be working with brood stock that is from your bioregion, when you can source your feeds in a customized fashion that starts to think about how to mimic the natural diet and the migratory pattern of this fish, when you start to pay attention to the water quality and make sure that the water flow really has this fish swimming and living a fish's life and not living in a bathtub, All of the, when you don't overstock it,
Not unlike a chicken living in a tiny little cage.
Follow the same logic. Industrial producers in densities can get to 30, 40, we've heard as high as 70, you know, we'll call fish per liter per unit of water. Our guys are dealing with amounts like 7, 10, 12. So the fish that are in there are schooling at a level that is an appropriate level of life.
Right, they're packed no more densely than they would than they might normally find themselves in a large school,
or less.
Let me ask you a question. Salmon is one of our favorite fish in America, and
yep.
Salmon is one of those fish that we've talked a lot about. The wild salmon stocks are under pressure.
Yep.
Some of the irresponsible fish farms are putting those stocks under greater pressure from genetically modified salmon.
There was a time when we were telling our customers not to buy farmed fish.
Now, you have a fish farmer, fish producer, Locke Duhart. I pronounced that for me.
Locke Duhart. Think Stewart with a D.
Okay.
Locke Duhart.
So Locke Duhart is a different kind of salmon farm, and that's where you source your salmon. I think let's get away from the politics and the philosophy of it for a moment, and let's talk in brass tacks about what a responsible fish farm does, what Locke Duhart does that other fish farms don't do, and maybe what they don't do that other fish farms do. What's the difference? What do they do?
Well, I started to articulate some of it, actually. One of the things that they do is they don't buy their fish and smolt from some other multinational place in some other category in some other part of the world. They work with the indigenous broodstock from their streams. That's one point. They look to placing their nets and their cages for growing out the fish in rough, tidal flow waters so that their fish live a fish's life and are constantly being washed and constantly being challenged in currents that are, you know, 5-7 meter tides, serious tidal positions. They don't overly densely pack the fish. They feed the fish with a customized feed that all the big multinational groups initially said they couldn't possibly get. Well, they went out and created it.
Now, how do they get this feed? Is the feed take land-based protein and feed it to the fish? How do we feed salmon in a salmon farm?
Salmon are piscivorous fish. They eat other fish. You can start to play with some vegetable supplements to a certain point, but you can't take a carnivorous, piscivorous fish and turn it into a vegan and expect that fish to live its natural life, be happy, and end at the end of it.
And taste like salmon.
To taste like salmon.
Right.
So the thing about the feeds, there are so many complex points here, but one of them is to realize that there's so much waste in the human system that we should be all capturing for fish meal, that when you have fish meal, you need to stop feeding it to pigs and chickens and other animals that should never naturally ever see
right.
a fish.
Right.
But the only responsible place to have fish, if it's not being fed to humans, is to feed it to fish.
Mm-hmm.
Or bears.
Yeah,
so there are some simple sets of equations like that that should just, you know, fall into their natural rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these
practices of necessity are more expensive, and that's why agribusiness doesn't, even disregarding for a moment the massive economies of scale that corporate fishing interests have.
Yeah.
Is it a lot more expensive to raise fish this way?
You know, 15% pays for a lot of sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
You guys are chefs in your own right. You know, if I want to pay more for this fish and give a 5-ounce portion instead of a 7-ounce portion, how much are my people going to complain?
Well, we just give the 7-ounce portion and charge more.
what I'm saying is, in some market targets, and in most of our white tablecloth targets, that's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
If I was going to charge $21, I'd charge $23. If indeed the people know that this goes towards sustainable practices, most of the people in our market would say fine.
Well, let me.
I'm going to just interject there for a second. I don't think that it's that. Even necessarily, your customer needs to know that you're practicing sustainable agriculture in order to pay that extra money. Most of my customers will pay it simply for the better quality fish.
Well, you know, one of my favorite stories is about Locke Duart coming and visiting me. We were going to go to a sustainable seafood conference together, and we're having dinner here in San Francisco, and a phone rings. And it turns out to be one of the London papers and asking for a couple of fish for a sample or for a party or something. It wasn't really clear what it was. And so they called immediately, just put down the phone, called their London distributor and said, would you please put a couple of fish that we sent down to you for sale? Just throw them in a box and take them over to the paper, please. They're going to have some tasting of some kind, and they want it for tomorrow morning. There's no time to do anything else.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out that was part of the beginnings of a nationwide contest that became the Taste of Britain Award, about which nobody knew anything. This is the first year this was happening. And at the end of it, Prince Charles got involved. He wanted all of the heritage foods to be represented and so on and so forth. And they were tasting foods from up and down all over the country. And at the end of like 5 months of tastings, there was awards, gold, silver medal awards, gold, silver, bronze awards given in seasonal, regional, organic, wine and beverage, and best overall food. The gold medal winner for best overall food, Taste of Britain Award, was Locke Duart salmon.
The best food, period.
Best food, period. And what I love about the story is that was just two fish sent over from any other fish that was being sold that day.
Right, it wasn't specially selected.
Precisely. That's the level of quality they turn out every single day.
And it's good for you and good for the environment at the same time. Hey, we're going to take a quick break, but we're going to come back and talk more with Tim O'Shea about clean fish and how you can get your hands on some clean fish and, more importantly, get some in your mouth. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't, based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, with Stage Left and Captain Lombardi. We're talking with Tim O'Shea about his company, Clean Fish, which is a trademark name. And when you get Clean Fish trademarked as such, you know you're getting something that's good for you and good for the environment and quite tasty.
So, Tim, you come off this model, places like Nyman Ranch, where I know you spent some time working, or Heritage Foods,
right,
or a lot of these land-based aggregators is the word you used.
Right.
Where are you finding these people who are producing these sustainable fish and bringing them to you? How are you finding your sources?
Well, in many ways, it's our close networks with conservation groups and slow food groups and chefs collaboratives and producers one to another. They start to almost self-select and say, oh, you know, I think that these guys are the best ones who do this kind of abalone, and I think that's your market. Or we'll have World Wildlife Funds come and say, we got some shrimp producers in the Gulf of California. You know, we're trying to get them to change gear. Would you meet with them? I meet with them, and they all go, okay, we'll change gear if we can work with clean fish.
Nice.
I
think people sometimes don't realize that 50% of my job is finding producers like this, that's easily 50% of what we do at our restaurant.
Oh, you bet. I mean, you know, sourcing and vetting out. I mean, look at the level of confusion everybody is put into with the news and the press, and as helpful and as great work as so many NGOs do, you start clicking around on the web, and pretty soon you just get discouraged. You don't know what's good for you, what's good for the planet. You know, it's a lot easier to just go be vegan and forget the whole thing.
I think, except for an abiding love of steak, I agree. but, you know, the problem is with fish, it is a complicated issue. And why, you know, we had some folks from the Monterey Bay Aquarium on, and they have, sure, a little pocket. You can go to our website and find out how to get a little pocket guide to see what's
right,
healthy and what's not, and what's good for the environment and what's not. But what's nice about clean fish is you look at that we trust you. Is it the brand? Is it the consumer can trust, and the restaurateur can trust your company? And you've figured out, you know, I don't know exactly why one conch is sustainable and why it's not. And frankly, I don't have the time to look at every single bit. What I need to do as a restaurateur, and there are a lot of restaurant folks who listen to this show, is find a purveyor that I believe in. And so when I do get called out of my restaurant for, they say, okay, I hear you on the radio talking about sustainable and local. What about that? I can actually say, you know what, let me get back to you on it. Call my purveyor and know that you've got my back and sort of source some of that out to you.
Well, and we really, from the start, decided that was exactly the service we had to step up to the plate for. And as a result, we don't deal in any fish that, if it's an aquaculture product, I have been to the farm, I have walked through every aspect of their development, I have walked through their feed systems, I've walked through their processing. If it's a wild fishery, I've been out and met with the fishermen. In some cases, I've been out on boats with them. I've sat in the dock and watched how they bring the fish in. We have done everything we can to have a face-to-face relationship with every single source that we bring to you.
And I just want to point out to everybody, you know, we do have people on from non-governmental organizations and environmental groups, et cetera, and so forth. Clean Fish is a for-profit business. These artisanal producers are not out there, you know, making pottery because they enjoy making pottery and they have another day job. These are people who are making a living, bringing in fish in traditional ways or in new ways that they've thought a great deal about, and they're for-profit businesses. And all you folks who are in the restaurant business who listen to this show, you know, good ecology and good economy are often one and the same. And they're, you know, people want this stuff and they're willing to pay for it. And so it's not just a matter of doing good or doing hard work that's good. You know, doing good and doing well can often be the same thing. And I think this is a case of that.
Well, thanks very much. It's great to hear that. And part of our responsibility is also bringing to the chefs the full richness of the story behind this fish.
Mm-hmm.
So that people really get really the full, what we're really doing in aquaculture, I might say, for the first time, is borrowing a phrase from Wendell Berry about agriculture. We're recreating and redefining the culture of quality aquaculture. And there's a quality, amongst the guys that we work with, part of the problem, part of the difference between our approach to market driven forces and the NGO's advocacy is we're going out and finding guys who are already the best, who are already doing this from their sense of ethics and their sense of values. They are champions. They are eco-warriors out there. And we're honored to be able to actually bring their products to a marketplace that will respect and recognize it.
I also want to point out one other parallel, is that a lot of these guys are guys who own their own boats or guys who own their own land and say, you know what? I don't want to work for a big corporation. I want to do this the way my grandfather did it, the way my father did it, or the way that it's been done here for a long time. And, you know, we are restaurateurs. We're small businessmen. And, you know, that is in the fabric of America. So it's not just the story of the fish. It's also the story of the people that, that bring the fish to you. And it's not just out of the, you know, a selfless desire to save the planet, although most people who work with the land on a personal level and a non-corporate level have a great deal of respect for the land that sustains them or the ocean that sustains them. But it's about a traditional American way of life.
You know, reconnecting these quality of producers with these quality of consumers. One of your colleagues, a good friend and associate who I'm sure you know well, Peter Hoffman over at Savoy.
Oh, yeah, he's great.
And Peter was on a panel with me, and he heard some of my producers talking about what they do, and he heard what Cleanfish was doing, and he stood up and said, you know, the folks who walk in my restaurant, they're as hungry for these stories as they are for the fish.
Absolutely. And hopefully we provided you out there with some stories today. Our guest has been Tim O'Shea. He's the co-founder of Clean Fish, a company bringing you sustainable and tasty fish. We'll be back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1155. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, of Stage Left at Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Talking about fish today.
So when I saw the title of today's show and I saw it was Clean Fish, I thought somebody was going to teach me how to clean fish. Yes.
No. I have a fish story.
You do?
Well, it's not like
is
a fishing.
Is it a fish tale? Is
it's
it,
not
is
a fish
it,
tale.
Is it a Francis story?
No. I think I may have told this on the air once before, but not everyone listens to every show, so if you've heard it before, just, you know, bear with me. I will always remember.
20 years I've heard every one of your stories.
I will always remember. I was working in the dining room. I was the maitre d' one night at Stage Left years ago. And a woman was quite busy, so I went over and I spoke to a table and I greeted them and I told them the specials myself, and I said, you know, tonight we have a grilled tuna. And the woman looked at me like I had three heads. And she said, "Grilled tuna?" I said, "Yeah, we've grilled tuna with, you know, whatever we're serving it with, and you know, we have a wood-burning grill in the back, and it's delicious." "You grill tuna? You grill tuna?" I said, "Yeah, we grill tuna." "Uh-huh, absolutely." She said, "Well, I gotta see that." So I can't figure out this woman's response for the life of me. So when her entrees come out, I make sure that I'm at the table. And she looks up and she goes, "Oh, I got it." I said, "Do you like the tuna?" She said, "Yeah, I was thinking of the tuna in the can, and I was thinking how you would keep it from falling through the grates on the grill when you put it on there.
Funny stuff. Yeah. You know, I have the exact opposite story.
Tuna's a fish. Actually, before they put it in a can, it was a fish.
I have the exact opposite story. I went to a restaurant that was trying to get some critical acclaim years ago, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, and I ordered the tuna salad.
Right.
Okay, thinking I was going to get sliced tuna served over greens.
Yeah, wrong.
And I got the tuna salad. So
you want a quarter pound of that? Quarter pound of that, slice of bologna, what do you need?
That restaurant no longer exists.
Yeah, well, but ours does, and it's important to eat sustainably. Look up, you can go to our website, restaurantguysradio.com, to find out more about sustainable agriculture. Clean Fish and the Monterey Bay Aquarium are the sites to look at.
And remember, tuna salad should never cost $19.95.
Hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.